At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
February 1st, 1917, Germany announced a return to unrestricted submarine warfare against the United States and other carriers across the Atlantic, supporting Britain or France or any of the Allies. That led to, within 9 weeks, Woodrow Wilson asking Congress to declare war on Germany. In 1930-1940, Germany again using submarine warfare to cut off Britain, to starve it. That led to the U.S. throwing everything we had in the arsenal of democracy in defense of Great Britain. If Britain falls, Europe falls, and the U.S. is immediately vulnerable to German depredation in the Atlantic. 1941, Pearl Harbor, and the U.S. was in the war. Sea power, I learned from George Friedman, is the American strength. Here we are in the 21st century. George, a very good evening to you. George is the chairman and founder of Geopolitical Futures. Sea power in the 21st century. What evidence do we have of the U.S. sea power, first in Ukraine and then in the Pacific? Ukraine first. How are we doing, George? Good evening to you.
In Ukraine, we have basically a standstill with a major land power, the Russians. It is very difficult to bring our strength to bear, the Navy. We can move into the Black Sea. We can possibly move into some other waters around it. But it is the Russian choice whether to go to sea power, not the American. And that's troubling because our greatest strength is the ability to cut and divide and control the seas. And we're not going to be able to do this in this war.
In the first round with the Russians, then called Soviets, the Soviets attempted to enter the North Atlantic with their submarine fleet. I believe they also deployed out of Vladivostok, their bases in the east. How'd they do, George?
They didn't do very well. What they were trying to do was cut the supply line between the United States and Europe because that was essential. We had to get our supplies continually there. And if they cut that, they couldn't do it. But the U.S. had deployed carrier battle groups, submarines, aircraft, an entire array of things that made it impossible for the Russians to achieve this. And this was the prime cause of the loss of the Cold War for them, rather than many of the other things we talk about.
Yes, the Atlantic is one wall of the fortress. Now to the Pacific. The Japanese made a move on cutting the supply lines to Australia. The U.S. responded eventually and overwhelmed the Japanese, bringing it to the 21st century. The Chinese have the same geography, the same plan, first island chain, second island chain. Right now, the contest, how would you measure it between these two powers, China and the U.S.?
I'd say the U.S. is doing very well. The fear of the Chinese is that someone will cut their supply lines out of their eastern ports. China is an exporting power. If it doesn't export, it collapses. And it has to keep them over. It's terrified of the United States. So the United States can and will cut those supply lines. In the meantime, the waters east of China are completely in the control of the U.S. Navy, which means that breaking out becomes a very difficult thing. Invading Taiwan, which they talk about, they never do because the U.S. Navy is interdicting. So in that war, unlike Ukraine, the U.S. Navy is the critical power.
A man named Mahan, a U.S. professor, a naval veteran at the Naval War College in the 19th century, created the Mahan School of Confrontation between Fleets. The Japanese followed it very carefully and led to catastrophe. The Chinese, I'm told, followed very carefully, and it not yet has led to catastrophe. What is Mahan's strategy, and how are we doing with our version of Mahan?
Well, Mahan says the United States cannot be invaded by land. Canada can do it, and Mexico can do it. It's not going to happen. The threat to the United States is sea lanes. They would come that way. And therefore, the United States builds fleets to make that an inconceivable action. Now, in order to do that, you have to be a major industrial power, which the United States is. If you're not a major industrial power, which even China isn't at this point, carrying out the Mahan strategy won't work. Didn't work for the Japanese. So remember that industrial capability, naval power guards the United States in the Atlantic and the Pacific.
The threats to Taiwan are constant. The rhetoric is overwhelming sometimes. Most recently, the U.S.-Philippines exercises in the South China Sea and around the waters of the Leyte Gulf have led to a furious denunciation by China. Why, George? What does the U.S. and the Philippines represent to China? What worries them?
That we are going to block their access to the Pacific and ultimately block their access to the world markets. On the other hand, the United States has, in having the ability to do that, really limits China's ability to complaining about it. And they try to, in the Philippines, get the Philippine government to move somewhat in their direction and failed. The U.S. strategy in the region is to keep the line from Japan to the Philippines in a pro-American position. It succeeds, partly because the Navy is so powerful, and therefore the Chinese are reduced to making threats.
One more historical example I bypassed in the 20th century, but it's an example of when there is no U.S. naval power, I learned from George's column. That's Vietnam. Did we have a naval strategy in Vietnam, and what was the consequence?
Well, Vietnam was land warfare, guerrilla land warfare, pitting a very sophisticated crew, the Vietnamese, against the U.S., who wasn't trained there. The sea power never came into it. There was no naval operations, aside from air power to some extent, that could make a difference. And because of that, and because of the fact that our land forces were not really focused on the enemy, we lost. Others will say we didn't lose. It was a tie. We lost. And having lost, it was because our great power could not be brought to bear, telling us, don't go to war if you can't bring your Navy to bear.
The Chinese have the same map of the Pacific that we do. Do they see their vulnerability, that we can blockade them in the event of war breaking out over Taiwan? Do they have a plan to project power as far as Hawaii?
If they had a plan, they would execute it. They don't. Here's a problem. Just invade Taiwan. They have to send amphibious assault vehicles across, simultaneously landing in Taiwan. That would take about 9 hours minimum, if everything went right, never does, for them to cross the straits. By that time, our satellites would pick them up. Our missiles could knock them down. Now, are the Chinese sure that we would do this? No. But the risk that the United States could and would do it is enough to get them not to invade. The thing to think about China is they have been threatening Taiwan for years. And even when the U.S. was diverted in places like Vietnam, it didn't attack because it understands its vulnerability.
Right now, George, the balance of power is said to be between China and the U.S., but your analysis, it looks like it leans towards the U.S. Is that a fair conclusion? We have a few seconds.
Very heavily. The Chinese don't have the ability to conduct global war. And any war that we would have at this point would be global, unfortunately. And therefore, the Chinese can speak of it, but if they're sucked into a global war in the Central Pacific, for example, they simply could not do it. And that's why we've had peace for a long time.
George Friedman, the founder and chairman of Geopolitical Futures. I'm John Bowden.